Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 23rd of September 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is episode number 51 titled Britons and Saxons, and we will be returning to what we were talking about before Truthvids came and joined us. But of course I do have with me today my regular co-host, the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Patriarch, good day, sir. How is life treating you?
Hey, Sven. Thanks for having me back. Everything's good. I'm currently in, still in Romania, living in a, well, not living, but just residing in someone's flat for now, whilst we do some things. It's like an ex-communist flat. It's quite an experience, to be honest.
Oh, I bet. I recently saw the inside of an Orthodox church in Romania, and it looked incredible. Really, really ornate. Have you had a chance to look around the churches?
I've seen quite a few in a city called Oradea at the moment. And there's in the centre, it's been renovated quite well, a much better standard to a lot of other parts of the city. But yeah, there's a lot of the old kind of cathedrals and churches there. And they, you know, they're really a testament to kind of, you know, our traditions, really, in Christianity. So it's quite nice and refreshing, because obviously in the West we're used to a kind of really watered down kind of tradition.
Yeah, it still has liveliness to it, doesn't it? The Orthodox faith, and also in Romania, Cornelia Codrianu was a great hero, and he was a great hero, nationalist hero of the Orthodox Church. I think some of them refer to him as a saint, and he had a big influence on Romania before communism. And it's just nice to see the way that these churches just have this sense of grandeur, and they're still filled with people, and it gives you an idea of what the church used to be like in Britain, because we used to be Anglo-Orthodox. The Orthodox Church today is probably closer to what the churches were like before the schism in 1060, when Roman Catholicism became one branch and the Eastern Orthodox Church became the other branch. But before that, it was just Eastern Orthodox. And we can read in Alfred the Great, The Life of Alfred the Great, he talks about a religious ceremony, and it's very clear that it's in tune with the Orthodox ceremony of today. I forget what the word is used, chrism or something like that, and it's still a part of the Orthodox Church today. And Alfred the Great is a saint in the Orthodox Church, but that's all much later than the time we're going to be talking about now. As I mentioned in the last episode before Truthvids came to join us, we were talking about King Constantine the Third. Or King Constantine II, he goes by both names. He was a British king, and he went to Gaul to fight against Alaric the Goth and against the invaders that had crossed the Rhine, and he defeated them, and then he was made joint emperor of Rome. And we got to just discussing him last time, and what I would like to begin with today is Alan Wilson talking about this same king, because that will refresh our memory, I think. So this is taken from a quote by Alan Wilson. In AD 406, a vast confederation of the German Vandals, Suaves and Alans crossed the Rhine and devastated Gaul. The Roman armies were defeated and Gaul was in chaos. The word vandalism of today originates from the destruction carried out by the Vandals 1,500 years ago. Anyhow, to prevent these German tribes from reaching the Channel, the British king, Constantine III, a cousin of Arthur I, took the British armies over into Gaul, where his general Geraint defeated the Vandal Confederation and penned them up against the Pyrenees. King Constantine sat in Treves while his general Geraint fumed and strove to get him to attack Honorius of Rome. So the British were definitely not weak and helpless. But Rome was. While this was going on, Alaric the Goth took his chance and invaded Italy, and he proceeded to sack Rome. The helpless Roman Emperor Honorius wrote a letter to the Italian citizens in the southern city of Regium, in the province of Brittium, on the toe of Italy, informing them of Alaric's approach and stating that he could not help them, and they had to try to defend themselves. They were on their own. In one of many outrageous historical frauds, the English took this letter that was sent to Brittium in Italy and transformed it into a letter sent to independent Great Britain. All this is very well recorded by Zosimus and Olympiodorus. The English academics took this very clear record and turned the helpless citizens of Rhegium in Brittium in Italy into the powerful British, whose armies and king had just conquered Gaul and saved the empire. For centuries they have lied their heads off, alleging that this letter from Honorius was sent to the weak, helpless British who were allegedly dependent upon Roman protection. This letter is a virtual article of faith in academia, and generations of British people have been misinformed by this alleged fact. The truth is very different. This at the same time that the British had transported their armies into Gaul and defeated the Vandal Confederation that had mauled the Romans. This has to be one of the monster lies of history, and it is one of many similar, all designed to distort and destroy British history. The powerful British were very well able to take care of themselves, and the Romans had been kicked out of Britain several decades long before 411. Now, you may be aware of this patriarch, because I've heard this. It's a common trope in history that when the Saxons came to Britain, we wrote to Rome begging them for help, and Rome wrote back to us saying, "Well, I'm very sorry, but we just can't help you." And that's this letter. And as it says here, it was actually sent to Brittium in Italy, not to Britannia. And the British army had just defeated all of these Vandal tribes on the Rhine. So to claim that we had no strength and the Romans just couldn't help us, it's just a scandal, really. It's just trying to cover up the real history of what was going on here.
So by saying that we depended on help, kind of discredits the depth and greatness of the civilization of Britain at the time, basically.
Definitely, yes, and it hides the fact that Britain was, it was very, very powerful. They needed us to defeat these Vandals that were over there in France.
And what was our relationship like with Rome at the time? I mean, we had the three long wars, didn't we? And then Rome had its influence within Britain. So where do we stand in respect of Rome at the time of that alleged letter?
Well, Rome had actually left, and Constantine, who is Constantine III, he was king of Armorica, but he was of a British line because Armorica was owned by Britain at that time. And he was invited to come back to Britain to be the king of Britain. And he then, by his troops, because his troops were British and they were in the Roman army, they proclaimed him emperor, the emperor of the west side of Rome, of the Roman Empire. And then he went to Gaul and defeated all the all these Vandals and Saxons and all the rest of them. But when he went to Gaul, he took with him all the best of the army. He took the whole army, basically went with him into Europe, leaving no army left in Britain. And then we also, apparently there's a comet, which I haven't got any details on. We will eventually talk about it, which Alan Wilson talks about. He says that all the records say that there was a comet that actually hit Britain at that time, and it destroyed a lot of the buildings, the palaces, all sorts, and there were no crops. And this is the wasteland that's talked about in the histories of King Arthur. And the records show that there was this comet that hit Bolivia, and they've done a lot of research on it in Bolivia. And the direction that it was traveling in, it would have traveled right around the globe and then hit Britain. So that's their proof of it. And there's also geological proof of it. So what we had the British army, all the alpha males had gone off to France to fight with Constantine III. Then we have this comet that hits Britain, and then the Saxons arrive. So Britain had been extremely weakened because the Saxons were illiterate. And you had these Britons that had this civilization here with the Druids and with the tin mining. You know, the tin mining had gone on for, 2,000 years by this point. 2,000 years by this point we'd actually been tin mining for. So we had civilization.
Yeah, so I guess as it stood then at that point in time, you had a civilization that was probably they was a little bit more comfortable, or the strongest warriors had gone away, and then you're probably left with more of the intellectuals and just general civilians. And then if the Saxons were illiterate, they obviously used their might to get by in the world, and they were a much more hardened people at that time, and they obviously just was able to dominate when they ransacked Britain.
Yeah, and I think another point to make here is the unpatriotism, or the they're so against a patriotic version of history, the English historians, to try and make out that Britain had nothing until the Romans came here. We were a useless, weak nation that couldn't defend ourselves. You know, using this letter that was sent to Britium and then claiming it was sent to Britannia. I mean, what we're doing here is we're telling a patriotic history. So we're looking at the strengths of the British. But whereas our historians, you know, they never miss a chance to do us down and pretend that, you know, we were just idiots living in caves while all these civilizations were going on in the Near East. Continuing then with R.W. Morgan, whose book about the British Cymry is the main one that we've been using for this series. He says, of the British army, part returned to Britain and part settled in Armorica. Constantine was the third British sovereign that within a century had crossed the Channel and reigned at Paris as absolute masters of the whole West, as Wellington and the British Army of Occupation were of France from AD 1815 to 1821. Constantine was succeeded AD 412 by his second son, Constance, and if we remember, Constantine was assassinated, and I think also Geraint, his general, may have had something to do with it, because he wouldn't go and fight against Honorius. He was succeeded by his second son, Constance. Vortigern, his relative, possessed of large estates in most parts of the kingdom, caused him to be assassinated by his Pictish guards in AD 420. The two youngest sons of Constantine were Ambrosius, who is known to us in history as Aurelius Ambrosius, and Uther. And Uther is the father of Arthur II, probably the more famous King Arthur. And we will eventually get to him. And we'll also talk about Arthur I.
Is that the same name, but just a slight difference in kind of language, Uther and Arthur?
No, I think... it's just Uther was the name of his father, and Arthur was the name of his son. Mm. You know, maybe they changed it just to differentiate between the two. But I think there is a U in Welsh and there is an A in Welsh. Right. Okay. I think so. Yeah, there would be that difference there. So they were saved from a similar fate by a rapid flight into Brittany. Vortigern, in a public convention, placed the crown, like Richard III and Napoleon in later times, on his own head. The character of Vortigern, the second of the arch traitors of the Isle of Britain, is depicted in the blackest colours by the British historians, and even now his name is rarely mentioned without some epithet of hatred and execration. He seems indeed to approach very nearly to the character generally considered fabulous, a monster whose vices were unredeemed by a single virtue. And I think it's Nennius in his history. He does a history of Britain, and he talks about what an absolute rotter this Vortigern was. He was an absolute tyrant. And if they think the word Vortigern was some title for arch tyrant rather than his actual name. Have you heard of Vortigern before, Patriarch?
No, I've not even heard the name before, Vortigern.
Yeah, he's the king that invited the Saxons in, basically. So he was the one responsible.
I wonder what his motive was.
Well, we will get to that. In AD 430, the Saxons, Picts and Irish broke through the wall of Severus at Thirlwall, ravaged the country and besieged Chester. St. Germanus, and we talked about St. Germanus before as well, who put down the Pelasgian heresy, brother-in-law of the British king of Armorica, being engaged at the time in suppressing the Pelasgian heresy, first broached by Morgan, or Morien, president of Bangor, led the British army against them and gave them a total defeat at Mascarmon on the Alone near Mold, AD 435. Vortigern was publicly excommunicated by the same intrepid prelate at a synod of the British Church at St. Albans for incestuous commerce with his own daughter. So that's what he was accused of. And some historians say, well, that's just because they're trying to smear his name. But according to one history, he was excommunicated by St. Germanus for incest with his own daughter. And it's saying here the Saxons, the Picts and the Irish came down. And there is a question that maybe Vortigern actually had something to do with that as well. Maybe he was sort of encouraging the Picts to come in so that he had an excuse to invite the Saxons in. From this date, the traitor meditated the calling in of the Saxon Confederation into the affairs of Britain. In early life, he had served in the armies of Valentinian with two of the most distinguished of the Saxon king chiefs of the sacred race of Odin, two brothers, Hengist and Horsa. With them, secret communications were opened. The policy of engaging the barbarian mercenaries of one nation to garrison the frontiers against the incursions of another had, as we have seen, been long established in the Roman Empire, but this was the first precedent of the kind in Britain. So Vortigern's plan was to put the Saxons up there in the north to defend against the Picts coming in. And if you remember, Vortigern himself shouldn't really have been king. It should have been Constantine's, one of Constantine's sons, or Uther or Aurelius Ambrosius. But they're both in Brittany at the moment. They're keeping safe in Brittany. Do you want to add any comments to that?
Well, he obviously feared the Picts then. So I wonder what conflict they had between the Picts and why he thought it was necessary. Maybe there was just an uprising. They smelt weakness in the land, something like that. Thought it was their opportunity.
Yeah, I would imagine that's what it was. I mean, all of these tribes are constantly seeking to expand their territory and expand their wealth, aren't they? I mean, that's the way that that's the way that things go. So that's what the Picts would have been looking at, I think. So if we have a look at Wikipedia about Hengist and Horsa, it tells us Hengist and Horsa are Germanic brothers said to have led the Angles, Saxons and the Jutes in their invasion of Britain in the 5th century. Tradition lists Hengist as the first of the Jutish kings of Kent. Most modern scholarly consensus now regards Hengist and Horsa to be mythical figures, and much scholarship has emphasised the likelihood of this based on their alliterative animal names, the seemingly constructed nature of their genealogy, and the unknowable quality of the earliest sources of information for their reports in the works of Bede. Their later detailed representation in texts, such as the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, can tell us more about 9th century attitudes to the past than anything about the time in which they are said to have existed. And I'll just point out, I mean, Bede, I forget when he was writing, 6th or the 7th century. So if Bede is writing about them, and when the Saxons eventually get a teacher from Wales to teach them how to read and write, and they write down the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, I mean, there's no reason for them to be telling, you know, telling lies. They would have had bards that would have recited their history off by heart. They would have had folk tales about them. I mean, there's nothing to say that Hengist and Horsa didn't exist. This is just an example of the way that modern day historians tend to rubbish what was written in the past and try to claim that this was all mythical when these were actually our records. So Hengist and Horsa, I mean, yeah, I'm fairly certain they existed. You know, if Bede wrote about them, and then they wrote about them in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, and they are credited within the family tree of other kings, then, you know, they had to have existed, didn't they? Because it was so important to be able to recite your family tree and to say who it was that you were descended from. That was more important than anything else, because that defined what caste you were. Now, remember when we had Truthvids here, we were talking about the descendants of Odin. And that was why they had that right to rule, is because they were descended from Odin. It's the same thing here. I mean, that was Hengist and Horsa's right to rule. They came from Odin. That's why R.W. Morgan tells us they were chiefs of the sacred race of Odin. So they trace their ancestry back to Odin, and the kings that came after them trace their ancestry back to Hengist and Horsa. So, you know, they had to have existed.
I mean, even in you know, pop culture, the idea of having legitimacy to the throne is, you know, it's a commonly accepted theme, isn't it? So to actually place that in kind of in relation to how history unfolded, we're just kind of highlighting the details, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous to claim that they didn't exist when, you know, you've got family trees of royalty that have them in the family tree, because that proves that they should be royalty. I mean, it's just daft. But according to early sources, Hengist and Horsa arrived in Britain at Ebbsfleet on the Isle of Thanet. There goes the Isle of Thanet again. Remember, that was also where the Romans arrived.
It's on my map now.
Yeah.
It's on my map. I need to go there.
For a time, they served as mercenaries for Vortigern, king of the Britons, but later they turned against him. British accounts have them betraying him in the treachery of the Long Knives, which we will get to. Horsa was killed fighting the Britons, but Hengist successfully conquered Kent, becoming the forefather of its kings. A figure named Hengest, possibly identifiable with the leader of British legend, appears in the Finnsburg fragment and in Beowulf, and Hengist was historically said to have been buried at Hengistbury Head in Dorset. So we even have a place that's named after where he was buried. And Wikipedia will try and say, oh, they're just mythical figures. And it really is ludicrous the way that they do that.
I mean, do you think it's likely that there were more dramatic stories told later that could have in some way kind of distorted these characters to the point where people think, oh, they must have been fictional because that couldn't have happened, and so it just discredits the whole legacy of these people, Horsa and Hengist.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to add bits to them, make them out to have legendary abilities, I should imagine. I mean, they get talked about in German histories as well. In a lot of German myth and legend, they talk about Hengist and Horsa. So, yeah, there's probably parts of their legend which you know, are fabulous, but they did in actual fact exist. I mean, they had to have existed. Why else would Hengistbury Head be named after him, you know? Why else would these kings be name-checking them, as that's the reason for why they have the right to rule? Well, getting back to R.W. Morgan, an eruption of the Picts, encouraged by Vortigern, supplied the pretext desired. Hengist and Horsa landed at Thanet, between which and the mainland ran, so late as Bede's time, the Wantsum, three stadia broad and fordable only in two places. So that sounds like the Isle of Thanet is probably no longer an island, but back then there was a strait that ran between the isle and the mainland. Another armament landed at the mouth of the Nen near Peterborough. Uniting together, they defeated the Picts at Stamford near Lincoln. Alice, the daughter of Hengist, called Ronwen, the White-Breasted, or Rowena, or Ronixa, at the festivities given in celebration of the victory at Chilham Castle, Kent, excited a deep passion in the heart of the infatuated Vortigern. And to secure her hand, he bestowed the county of Kent on his father-in-law, Hengist. Garangon, the disinherited prince, appealed for redress to the national Gorset. So quite a few important things taking place here that have just been summarised. It looks like we have only two boats of Saxons that have arrived, and we could say three boats. And I mean, that's not enough to take on the whole of Britain, is it? And then they went up to Lincoln, where they defeated the Picts. So the Picts had obviously come down into England at that time. And then we have Ronwen or Bronwyn, Hengist's daughter, and her beauty manages to infatuate Vortigern. So Vortigern pays the price of Kent. He gives Kent to Hengist so that he can then marry Bronwyn, which obviously upsets Garangon, who was the prince who should have actually been given Kent. I mean, that was his kingdom, basically, and Vortigern just gave it to the Saxons. So the Saxons didn't conquer Kent, as it says in Wikipedia. The Saxons were just given Kent by Vortigern. Any thoughts on that?
Well, from that, you'd have to expect that they had a close relationship, or you know, some form of there wasn't hostility within a portion of the people of Britain, or at least some of the ruling elites at that time, you know. So it couldn't have been a completely hostile takeover, could it?
No,
as is told.
Yeah, and also, I mean, as we learned there, Vortigern had been fighting alongside Hengist in the Valentinian Guard, I think it said there. So, you know, they actually knew each other. Vortigern and Hengist knew each other. And obviously, Vortigern's nobles or his elites must have supported him. I mean, it was basically a power grab. So he was a tyrant. Mm. So he shouldn't actually be ruling in Britain. It should have been Aurelius Ambrosius or Uther that had had to go to Brittany, and he'd basically taken over. Now he's got the Saxons on side as well.
It makes sense, actually, to surround yourself. If you know that you don't have legitimacy to the throne, it would kind of make sense to bring in kind of outsiders, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Who wouldn't hate you or hold anything against you as much. So you build your, you know, strength from people on, you know, on a good footing as opposed to a bad footing.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it, that he would bring in outsiders because he wouldn't be wanted by the British. And despite of the powerful influence of the court or the Vortigern faction, the Saxons were ordered to quit Britain. Vortigern was solemnly deposed, and Vortimer, his eldest son, was raised to the throne and the Pendragonate. Hengist, allying himself with the Red Irish, or the Scots, and the Picts, took to the field at Aylesford in Kent, AD 455, when he was attacked by the British army under Vortimer and his brother Kinderen. Horsa and Kinderen fell in single combat, and Hengist was defeated. Three more Saxon defeats at Crayford, Stone, and Thanet resulted in their capitulation at the latter place on condition of being permitted to return with their wives and their children to the continent. So the Saxons were then defeated, and we've got the mention here of the Red Irish, and that's because that was a group from Ireland that had moved into Scotland, and they were called Scots after the Princess Scotta that we talked about in our two-part episodes on Jeremiah. It always catches me out, the fact that the Irish were called the Scots back then.
Yeah, it's a little odd, and it's the vice versa, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Scots were Irish.
And this took place over a period of 5 years as well, that this original group of Saxons were beaten and sent back to Germany. This was 457 to 462 AD. In AD 463, Vortimer died. He was poisoned by Ronwen. At his dying request, his tomb was raised on the spot in Thanet, whence he had taken the last view of the departing sails of the invaders. At the Gorsedd in London, Vortigern was restored to the throne, the second of the three fatal councils of the Isle of Britain. Hengist was re-invited, conditionally that he came with no larger a retinue than 500 men. But Abusa, a brother of Hengist, with his son Octa, landed in the Firth of Forth with an armament of 300 vessels. The British nation flew to arms. So obviously Vortimer must have been a son of Vortigern by an earlier marriage, and then he must have married this Ronwen, and then she poisoned his son, and yet he doesn't appear to be bothered by this at all. I mean, this gives us an insight into the sort of character that this Vortigern had, and I am surprised that they restored him to the throne at the Gorsedd. I mean, that wasn't really a very, very good idea. And then he invites Hengist back with his small retinue, 500 men, but then a huge armament arrives in Scotland, 300 vessels. So then, as it says here, the British nation flew to arms. A conference was then proposed by Hengist and accepted by Vortigern. It was held at Stonehenge, which some people say comes from Hengist's stones, and it was attended by most of the nobility of Britain. Now, this was supposed to be what's called a love day, a peace treaty. And when they went into the stone circle, they were not supposed to carry any weapons. And it was so that they could parley and they could come to some kind of truce. And this was an age old practice. As we learned earlier in this series, when we looked at the Druids and the Druids' laws, within the stone circles, they were sanctuaries, and that same law then became applied to the churches. So if you could, if someone was chasing you and you could get into a church, then you were safe because there could be no weapons in a church. You couldn't be attacked. And that stayed that way until Edward I, when the Scots attacked somebody and murdered him in a church up in Scotland. People want to learn about that, then they can look at, Edward I in the Greatest Britain series. But getting back to what's happening here, the Saxons and the Britons have arranged to make this peace treaty within this stone circle, and they're not supposed to have any weapons. And that's a tradition, like right the way across the continent, wherever they had these stone circles, that was the tradition. It was what civilized people did, basically. On the sixth day, at the high feast, when the sun was declining, was perpetrated the massacre of the Long Knives, the blackest crime, with the exception of that of St. Bartholomew, in the annals of any nation. The signal for the Saxons to prepare to plunge their knives, which had been concealed in their boots and under their military cloaks, into the breasts of their gallant and unsuspicious conquerors was, "Let us now speak of friendship and love." The signal for action were the words, "Nemitur summas," or "out with their knives," and the raising of the banner of Hengist, a white horse on a red field, over the head of Vortigern. 480 of the Christian chivalry of Britain fell before sunset by the hands of the pagan assassins. Three only of name, Idol, Count of Gloucester, and the princes of Vinodotia and Cambria escaping, the first by almost superhuman strength and presence of mind. Priests, ambassadors, bards, and the boyish scions of many noble families were piled together in one appalling spectacle on the site of the banquet, Moel Acre, or the Mound of Carnage, it is called, about 300 yards north of the great Druidic temple. The horror produced by this act of unexampled perfidy was never effaced from the British mind. "Death to the man that trusts the stranger" became henceforth the watchword for hostilities, that so far as the eldest tribe of the Cymry were concerned, may be said to have lasted with transient interruptions until the ascension of the Tudors to the throne, because the Tudors had ancestry. They actually had Cymric ancestry that goes back to Brutus. So this was just unheard of, the most uncivilized, barbaric thing that could ever have happened, to just go back on tradition like that and murder all the chiefs, all the nobles of the Britons that have been trying to come to some kind of agreement with the Saxons. And I mean, to carry this out, as they said, "Let us now speak of friendship and love." I mean, that's just incredible. So you can see why the Welsh had a grudge against the Saxons because of this. And also, this is what it was called, the Night of the Long Knives. And obviously, at the same time, or in I forget exactly what date it was, but with the National Socialists, when they had their purge of the subversives within their movement, that was called the Night of the Long Knives, and that was in reference to this. That was in reference to this. This was the first night of the Long Knives. I mean, it's an absolute tragedy.
They're likening it to one of the greatest kind of treacherous moments. Kind of two-faced, sort of underhand.
Yeah, I mean, I should imagine they were looking at it as something they could be proud of. How they should have been given the County of Kent, but they weren't. So they got their own back on them by killing all the nobles. I mean, I don't understand it, because it's obviously not a good thing. It would be interesting to see the way that the Germans actually look at the Night of the Long Knives, the original one. I mean, maybe that's something we could look into for next week. And obviously this, the proof that this happened, because up next to Stonehenge, there is the Mound of Carnage, which is where that was the site of the banquet.
Right.
The Mound of Carnage. Ambrosius and Uther were summoned from Armorica, and the nation flocked to their standard. Vortigern, who had secreted himself from the storm of national odium behind the defiles of Snowdon, was besieged, and with Ronwen and his principal adherents, consumed by fire near Nevin in Carnarvonshire. Hengist himself was taken prisoner at the Battle of Masbelly, tried and executed as an assassin at Coningsburg in Yorkshire, so called Coningsburg or Kingsburg from the mound that was raised over him. That's interesting, isn't it? Conig is German for king, isn't it? So Königsberg, Kingsburg, and that was built on the mound that was raised over Hengist, so another proof that he existed. Octa and Abusa, that was his sons, who had escaped to York, shortly afterwards surrendered themselves with chains in their hands and sand on their heads, declaring that their gods were vanquished by the god of the Britons. They were then settled as a barrier against the Picts on the Firth of Forth, and from them descend the Scotch of the Lothians. So the people that live in the Lothians are descended from those Saxons. Do you want to raise any points there or pick up on anything?
Just a point that I'm seeing a common theme in a lot of historical civilizations. They would often use another people to as kind of like a border enforcer, and they'll be willing to bring outsiders in to defend their borders. It's like a human shield, isn't it? Or kind of just default frontline people.
Yeah, I mean, you can see it goes back to like the Assyrians did it with the Israelites, didn't they?
Yeah, exactly.
Putting them on the border.
That's where I was thinking.
Yeah, the Romans were doing it with the Saxons, and you got the same thing that is happening here. Well, let's have a look at what Wikipedia has to tell us about Vortigern. Vortigern was a 5th century warlord in Britain, known perhaps as a king of the Britons, or at least connoted as such in the writings of Bede and Gildas. So it must have been Gildas that was writing about him rather than Nennius that I spoke about before. His existence is contested by scholars, and information about him is obscure. He may have been the Superbus Tyrannus, said to have invited Hengist and Horsa to aid him in fighting the Picts and the Scots, whereupon they revolted, killing his son in the process and forming the Kingdom of Kent. So this is Wikipedia's version of it. They formed the Kingdom of Kent, as if there wasn't a kingdom there before. It is said that he took refuge in North Wales and that his grave was in Dyfed or the Lynn Peninsula. Gildas later denigrated Vortigern for his misjudgment and also blamed him for the loss of Britain. He is cited at the beginning of the genealogy of the early kings of Powys. So again, you know, he's there in a family tree as being an ancestor of the kings of Powys, and yet you got Wikipedia saying, oh yeah, we don't think he existed. His existence is contested. But, you know, you got people that wrote that down and remembered it at the time. They're eyewitnesses. And you got people who knew him as their grandfather, great-great-great-grandfather. And yet, the scholars think he didn't exist.
I think they're just kind of building off the back of, other historians that kind of came before them, so that they can't stray too far, can they? So, you know, when... It's just like becomes a perpetual kind of, not lie, but, distortion of the truth. It's the same with science, isn't it, really? Same thing goes for history. They have to stick with the certain predetermined narratives. Otherwise, they don't get their name out there as much.
Yeah, it's in everything, isn't it? History, science, everything's become distorted and subverted to serve other interests rather than, just serving the truth. Well, I also found a piece here on a website called kingarthursknights.com that also gives us some more information about this. To aid the Britons in their defence against the increasingly brutal raids from the northern tribes, Vortigern authorised the use of Saxon and Jutish mercenaries led by the princes Hengist and Horsa. In line with the standard Roman practice of employing one barbarian tribe to defend another, the Saxons received land to be used in settlement in exchange for their services. Geoffrey of Monmouth claims that the two brothers asked for all the land they could cover with a single oxhide. Vortigern eagerly agreed, but found that Hengist cut the hide into a lengthy thong that was able to encompass the whole city of Carcure, or Custer, in Lincolnshire. Vortigern must, however, have found reassurance in the words of the Jutish chief, as recorded in the Kentish Chronicle. Hengist said to Vortigern, "Take my advice, and you will never fear conquest by any man or any people, for my people are strong. I will invite my son and his cousin to fight against the Irish, for they are fine warriors." And I'll just pause there, because this bit with the single oxide, that's the same legend, wasn't it, that they had about Carthage?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember when I brought that up? Yeah, that's why I was wondering where I knew this bit about the single oxide actually covering Kent or whatever, and that actually comes from Geoffrey of Monmouth in his history. So that's a legendary feature that also featured in the settlement of Carthage. So again, it shows that it was the same people. The Saxons were the same, you know, the same biology, the same original people that settled Carthage. Again, and it was Israelites that settled Carthage. They'd actually left Israel when there was the famines that had happened with Baal. And remember, and that ties in with Troy as well, the same people from Troy, and they settled Carthage, and they got the same legend with the oxide. And then we see the legend with the oxide resurfacing again with the Saxons, who came from the Scythians, who came from the Israelites that, and the known as the Phoenicians at that time, who settled Carthage. So we have all these sort of legendary links between these peoples.
The land which was given them, was that Lancashire? So that's sort of middle north, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it says Lancashire here, but I think it says Kent in Geoffrey of Monmouth, and also it was Kent that was actually given to Hengist. So it says here the whole city of Carcure, and it says Caister or Lynx, but so I don't know where they get that from, because it was Kent, as far as I am aware. Well, continuing with what they say here, the anti-Pict or anti-Irish strategy that Vortigern chose to employ proved to be successful, since these tribes were never a problem again, and the arrangement between the Saxons under their leader Hengist and Vortigern was agreeable to both parties for some time. Later, however, they tricked the High King again, this time into handing over to them the sub-kingdom of Kent. Getting drunk at a celebratory feast, the foolish Vortigern fell deeply in love with Hengist's daughter, Rowena, and he promised Hengist anything he wanted, if only he could marry her, and Kent was the Saxon's price. So there you go. I must have been wrong. It was this city that they were given at first, and that was given with the oxhide, and Kent was given to him for his daughter Ronwyn. I was thinking that he had asked the price for the bride, and he said whatever I can put this oxhide around, and then he cut it up and put it around Kent. So maybe the two stories have got mixed together there. But the point of it is that it's the same legend that they had in Carthage. And also the foolishness of this king giving up Kent for.
And I wonder how populated Kent would have been at the time. Would it have been a case that they got to settle wherever they wanted amongst the rest of the population, native population, or were they just able to, you know, populate it and spread out into the areas which weren't inhabited?
Well, they would have been lording it over the native population, wouldn't they? I should imagine there were people there, and they would have brought with them the feudal system that that the Saxons had, which was very different to the British system. And they would have had they would have been seen as serfs, and the Saxons would have been seen as lords. So they were effectively saying, "This is the new king of Kent." So there would have been people there, and they would have had to serve Hengist.
So with the feudal system then, is that like a hierarchical structuring of society? So by default, they would have been kind of higher citizens, high class citizens?
Yeah, you would have had the lords, and then you would have had the serfs, the thralls, and you had a system of vergild where depending on what position you held in society, it was a different fine for if you got murdered. So, it's similar to today, really, depending on who you are. It depends on the sort of punishment that somebody gets. If you're an ethnic minority and you say that racism was an aspect of this crime against me, then the person who is paying the penalty for the crime is going to have his prison sentence increased, which effectively says that the ethnic minority is in a higher position in society than the indigenous British. And you had this same system here with the Wer Guild, only it was the lords that were above the thralls, and obviously the king was above all of them. And you had all these like petty kingdoms, basically like the Kingdom of Kent and Kingdom of Venedotia, Kingdom of Silurea. So you still had these Welsh kings, the Brittonic kings that were still in Wales, and now we have Kent, which is controlled by Hengist. So now we'll take a detour back to R.W. Morgan talking about the Saxon Chronicle. The Saxon Chronicle, the work on which the Anglo-Saxon story of the Teutonic settlement of England has hitherto rested, is rejected by the most recent Anglo-Saxon historians as a spurious production of the Augustine monks of Canterbury. The more I examine the question, states Kemble in the History of the Anglo-Saxons, page 16, the more completely I am convinced that the received accounts of the Saxon emigrations, subsequent fortunes, and ultimate settlement are devoid of historical truth in every detail. This repudiation by the Anglo-Saxon historians of their own authorities is a very curious and perplexing circumstance, leaving us either no foundation at all or one purely British for this portion of our story. It is certain, as Kemble elsewhere admits, that Saxon England, as the Saxon Church was essentially the child of Papal Rome, that her clergy were the emissaries of Rome, and that what we term the Saxon histories are nothing else than the writings of monks of the Roman Church, animated by a spirit of intense hatred and mendacity towards the British Church and the British nationality. Now, obviously, this guy is Welsh. He's very against the Saxons. I think there is truth to the Saxon Chronicle because it bears out what the British were actually saying. Obviously, when the Saxons are writing it, they try to turn it into propaganda. Like, for instance, when King Arthur defeats them, there's just a gap rather than actually saying what happens. And they wouldn't talk about the times that they lost their battles or what have you. And it's also very sparse. There's not a lot of details in there. And again, this is the mainstream historians that are saying, well, this history doesn't exist. It's all just mythical. You know, they do it to the Anglo-Saxons as well as doing it to the Welsh. It's a very sad state of affairs, to be honest. The Saxons themselves brought no alphabet with them into Britain. They adopted the British one. Most of the terms of agricultural, domestic, and civil life supposed to be Saxon are pure Logrian British, unchanged since the days of Caesar. The Augustine monks introduced the Roman alphabet, obviously because we, as the Britons, we had our Colburn alphabet. Of their very limited knowledge of Latin itself, the first clause in the Saxon Chronicle may be cited in evidence. Mistaking Hiberna for Hibernia, they send Caesar, after his first campaign in Britain, into Ireland instead of into winter quarters. As late as AD 878, Alfred could not find six priests in all Saxondom competent enough to read and write Latin, and he was obliged to have recourse to the British Church for a lawgiver and teacher. That was Asser, the Bishop of St. David's, for his rude subjects. Leaving, however, these questions to be settled by the Anglo-Saxon historians themselves, we shall here, before we proceed with the British, give the Anglo-Saxon or Augustine version, hitherto received, of the progress of the Saxon arms, abbreviated from their national chronicle. And they say that Alfred the Great and the Saxons of their time, they said that they couldn't read and write because they had spent so much time fighting against the Danes. And that was their excuse. And because of these battles with them, it had reduced them to, you know, a state of low civilization. And then they went to Wales to get a teacher, to teach them how to read and write. So again, that obviously shows that the Welsh or the Britons had a tradition of civilization, and they mm-hmm. knew how to read and write. So we have the abbreviated Anglo-Saxon Chronicle here now. AD 449, Hengist and Horsa land in Britain. They invite the Angles. They describe the luxury of the Britons and the richness of the land. Then came the three powers of Germany, Angles, Jutes and Saxons, AD 455. Hengist and Horsa fought the Britons at Aylesford. Horsa is slain. AD 457, Hengist and his son Esk fought the Britons at Whippensfleet and slew 12 generals, all Welsh. Whipped the Thane was slain. AD 473, Hengist and Esk fought with the Britons. AD 477, Ella came to Britain and fought with the Welsh at Cumershaw. Note, it doesn't tell you the outcome of the battles, you see. That's what I was saying about the propaganda. AD 485, yeah. Ella fought with the Welsh at Merchredslam. AD 490, Ella and Cissa took the city of Andred, Pevensey, and did not leave one Briton alive in it. AD 495, Cerdic and Cynric arrived at Cerdic Sora and fought the Welsh the same day. AD 501, Porter, Beda and Mela landed at Portsmouth and fought with Welsh and killed a Briton of high rank. AD 508, Cerdic and Cynric slew the British king, Nathan Loud, and 5,000 men with him. AD 510, Stuff and Witgar landed at Cerdic Scora and fought with the Welsh. AD 519, Cerdic and Cymric fought with the Britons at Cerdicsley. And that's interesting that they've got a name there, Cymric, which sounds like he was Welsh. Here, being the period occupied by the reign and Pendragonate of Arthur, follows a want of 33 years, sarcastically termed by Gibbon the discreet silence of the Saxon historians. AD 552, Cymric fought with the Britons at Sarum. AD 556, Colin and Cymric fought with the Britons at Banbury. AD 571, Cuthulf fought with the Britons at Bedford. 577, Colin fought with the Britons at Dereham. 584, Colin and Cutha fought with the Britons at Frethern. 591, a great battle was fought at Wanborough, and Colin was driven by the Britons out of his kingdom. 597, Colwulf began to reign and constantly fought with the Welsh. This year came Augustine and his companions to England. AD 607, Ethelfrith, king of Northumbria, led his army to Chester, where he slew an innumerable host of the Welsh, and so was fulfilled the prophecy of Augustine. If the Welsh will not have peace with us, they shall perish at the hands of the Saxons. There were slain 1,200 priests who had come hither to pray for the army of the Welsh, and that was the Bangor Massacre. AD 614, Cynegils and Quickelm fought against the Welsh at Bampton. AD 633, this year Edwin, king of Northumberland, was slain by Cadwallo the Briton and Pendar on the 14th of October. Osfrid his son was slain with him. Cadwallo and Pendar destroyed all the lands north of the Humber. AD 642, Oswald, king of the Northumbrians, was slain at Oswestry. His body was buried at Bardsey. 645, King Kenwal was expelled. 651, King Oswin was slain. 652, King Anna was slain. 655, King Pendar and three princes with him were slain at Wingfield. The Mercians became Christians. 661, the men of the Isle of Wight were made Christians. 664, this year began the Great Plague in Britain. 685, Cadwallar began to contend for the kingdom. 686, Cadwallar, or the Cadwal the Sanctus of the British Chronicles, desolated Kent. 688, Cadwallar went to Rome and was baptized by Pope Sergius and died there and was buried in his baptismal garments in the Church of St. Peter. To him succeeded Inna, or the Ivor of the British Chronicles, and reigned 33 years. He built Glastonbury for a monastery and then went to Rome and died there. AD 743, Ethelbald of Mercia and Cuthred of the West Saxons fought with the Welsh. 755, Cynwulf fought many hard battles with the Welsh. 787, this year came the first fleet of the Northmen, the Danes, into Britain. 833, this year King Egbert fought with the Northern pirates at Charmouth. A great slaughter was made, and the Danish men remained masters of the field. So we see that there's lots of battles there, lots of kings that listeners have probably heard of. lots of the Saxon kings end up getting slain between 640 and 660, and then you get the Mercians becoming Christians, the Isle of Wight becoming Christians. We get Augustine that turns up, and because the Britons went to actually meet with Augustine, he wanted to meet with the British church, and the Britons decided that if he stood up to greet them and showed respect to them, they would listen to what he said. But when they arrived, he didn't stand up to greet them. So they thought, this is very rude of Augustine. And because they didn't want to go along with what Augustine was saying, he made this prophecy that the Saxons would destroy them. And the Saxons went and killed loads of priests, basically, in the massacre of Bangor. Any thoughts on that?
Just a lot of war, really, isn't there? A lot of bloody history, basically. The bloody history we've got. But I can't help but think how it in so many ways shaped the nation to become Christian. You know, it's like there's a lot of bloodshed, but in many ways it kind of paved the way for mass adoption of Christianity, didn't it?
Yeah, well, there was all this bloodshed, but when the Normans came along, they did the same to the Saxons. You know, the Saxons were turned into slaves.
Roundabouts, for sure. But it all had its part in bringing about the faith kind of remained, didn't it? Christianity all kind of grew despite that. Like you could take the view that or expect that unless Christianity was being brought in by the people taking over already had adopted Christianity.
Well, no, the Saxons, they weren't Christians until Augustine came over, and I think one of the Saxon kings married a Christian. I think she was a Christian from France, and she insisted on having a priest, and they had a church that was in Kent that was set up. It was already one of the British churches that was there, and that was set up. I think it was a Brett Walder? No, not Brett Walder. I can't think of her name. I'm sure it was a princess from France rather than a British princess that actually married this Saxon king. And that was responsible for, I think, the first Catholic church there, because they instead of having the British priests from the British church, they called in Augustine and the priests of the Roman church.
Right. See?
And then Bede tried to run down the Britons, but the fact that the Britons already had a church there is very apparent in Bede's work. Well, R.W. has some criticisms. He says, "We shall dismiss the Saxon Chronicle with a few remarks. First, if authentic and genuine, it appears that for 100 years, AD 449 to 552, after their landing under Hengist and Horsa, not a single battle, that in which Nathan Loudfell excepted, was fought by the Saxons in the interior or elsewhere than on the spot of their disembarkation and under the protection of their marine camps, and that in all of these the Britons were the assailants, the Saxons acting merely on the defensive." So for 100 years they were just in one place, and they didn't actually branch out from there, and it was the Britons that were attacking them. "The character of these Pacific disembarkations, as here represented, must have been sadly misconceived by our ancestors. But in truth, the Saxons were no gentle colonizers. They were a race of pagan warriors, equally ferocious and fearless. And one inference can alone be drawn from such confessions as the above, that instead of finding, as they anticipated, an easy prey, such as the Franks had been found in France, the Visigoths in Spain, the Ostrogoths in Italy, and the Vandals in Africa, they were encountered by a race to whose arms these nations themselves had recently yielded on the continent. Instead of such emperors as Honorius or such mercenary generals as Stilicho, they were met by a succession of native heroes, Vortimer, Ambrosius, Uther, Arthur, Urien, Ivor, and Cadwallo, and curbed with an arm of iron within their naval stalls on the margin of the sea, until the fifth generation, when they had long ceased to be foreigners and had become British, not German Saxons. So what you're saying there is that they'd actually been in Britain for five generations. By that time, they had essentially become British. I mean, they were the same white people, and they'd become used mm-hmm. to the customs by then. And that was when they branched out and had their kingdoms, rather than it being, conquering the Welsh. So that's an interesting way to look at it.
Maybe it would have been easier for them to branch out because they'd face less hostility, being perceived as the same kind.
Yeah. I mean, that much better than going out and trying to conquer them. I mean, we had to branch out and find new places to live, basically, and that was just what happened with the Danes. When they had enough young males, they would set out at sea to try and find somewhere else to settle. And it was the same with these Saxons.
But I mean, even Britain there was so much forest land throughout Britain. Even sort of looking up some history, for example, in Sherwood Forest in the Midlands, close to where I grew up, there was so much forestation. It spanned for cities. So it's just literally big portions of land which were just deforestation, so that no doubt they would have had to expand into that and build up new cities and areas and villages.
Yeah, needed clearing. That forest land needed clearing and things being built upon it. Second, the Kingdom of the West Saxons is admitted to have been overthrown by the Britons after the Great Battle of Wanborough. Third, with the exception of a petty predatory excursion on the Isle of Wight, no expedition of the Saxon arms is recorded during the reign of Arthur, thus confirming the complete reduction of the Teutonic invaders universally assigned, amongst his other exploits, by history and European tradition to this king. Fourth, the massacre of Bangor is gloried in as the fulfilment of the menaces of Augustine against the church and nation which had peremptorily rejected the pretensions of the papacy. Fifth, the career of Cadwallo and his reconquest of the north of Britain are admitted. Sixth, his son Cadwallo Sanctus is claimed under the name of Cadwallar, a novelty in Saxon nomenclature, as a Saxon king, his mother being a sister of Pendar, the king of Mercia. So you see, by that time they were interbreeding, like they're intermarrying. Yeah, you had the British kings marrying the Saxon princesses and the Saxon kings marrying the British princesses. So mm-hmm. it obviously worked out that they originally had the same ancestry. Ivor is similarly converted into Inner, the Welsh Saxons being unable to pronounce the British. So Inner was actually Ivor. He was a Welsh king that the Saxons then claimed as their own. Seventh, 340 years after the landing of Hengist and 150 years after the Logrians had Saxonized, whilst the war still raged with unabated keenness between the elder tribe, the Cymry, and the Teutonic Britons in the west, the Cymry or Kimbri of the Baltic enter the arena under the name of the Norsemen, the Decaiad, the Danaiad, or the Danes, and strike in their own right for the crown and the inheritance of the island. So another interesting piece here, because the Danes came from the Cymric Chersonese, is what it was actually called, because one portion of the Cymry, as the Cimmerians, as they made their way into Europe, they went into Denmark and that area there, and that's where the Norse came from. Obviously that's where the Danes came from. So it was the Cymry coming into Britain, where there were other Cymric tribes. And of course, when we first started this series, we talked about how some of the kings of Britain were marrying the princesses in Denmark and around that area.
Yeah, I mean that's the point, isn't it? That people today say, "Oh, Britain's a nation of immigrants anyway, and a mixture of peoples," but you all cut from the same cloth initially. It's just we being explorers, we expanded so far and wide, we eventually came back on ourselves.
Yeah, you have families and that grow into tribes that grow into nations over time. The language changes, the alphabet slightly changes. You know, you have 1,000 years goes past, and people that originated as the same people have diverged and become two completely different nations, or maybe three or four completely different nations. I mean, the the Saxons were originally the Scythians, and the Cymry were originally the Cimmerians. But originally, the Scythians and the Cimmerians were the 10 tribes of Israel that were put up in Assyria. And that's where they can all be traced back to. So, you know, what originally started off as one group becomes, you know, a load of other groups. And then it becomes all the different nations that we have in Europe now. And that's where it goes back to. But they're all originally the same white people from the same from the same white family. Well, I think we'll leave that here for this week, Patriarch, unless you've got anything else you want to add, anything you want to finish up with.
No, I think I'm good with that. It's a lot to take in.
Yeah, it's a good place to pause here. Well, thank you very much for coming on today.
You're welcome. Thanks again for having me.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back, I think, the week after next with a new episode of Patriotic History, because I believe we have the PA monthly update next Friday. So we will see you again then. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.